Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
They took us down into a tunnel. It was nearly completely and utterly dark. They didn't bring us water to drink. They didn't bring us food. They just left us there.
She's one of the lucky ones. Speaking to CBC News, an Israeli hostage released by Hamas after being abducted on October the 7th, 200 days ago. It's a milestone as dark as that tunnel and the stories emerging from it. Because 200 days later, dozens of hostages remain. Hope for their release is fading. And after 200 days, an end to the fighting and suffering in Gaza feels as distant as day one. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Susan Bonner. It is Tuesday, April 23rd, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern, also on the podcast.
And here we go.
Yes, they do! It's a world record!
With the Paris Olympics almost here, a Chinese doping scandal calls into question results from 4 years ago and a race where Canada finished fourth.
We don't really understand their safety issue. We don't take no for an answer.
And return to sender, Canada Post deals a major setback to Ottawa's gun buyback program and may send the Trudeau government back to the drawing board. Accounts of darkness and captivity on a holiday honoring freedom and liberation from slavery. Jews around the world are celebrating Passover, but for many, this year is different. Aviva Siegel and her husband were taken from their home in Kfar Azah on October 7th and held hostage. She was freed after 51 days, but he remains in Gaza. Chris Brown sat down to talk to her about her ordeal.
This holiday takes me to Keith. He needs his freedom. The hostages need their freedom.
We met Aviva Siegel in her sister's home in Tel Aviv. As Jews celebrate Passover, her family is stricken by the inconsolable knowledge that her husband Keith has now been a captive of Hamas in Gaza for 200 days. The couple lived in the community of Kfar Azah near Israel's border with Gaza for four decades. They had just woken up on October the 7th when Hamas gunmen attacked.
And I remember saying to Keith, they're here. They're walking here just next to the door. They just opened the door like any door opens. And they pushed themselves inside. There must have been 15 of them with guns, with knives, shouting and screaming.
At least 60 people were murdered that day in Kfar Azah. Keith and Aviva were taken, the gunmen forcing them into their own car and driving them to Gaza, wearing nothing but their pajamas.
Keith and I were moved 13 times. One of the times, they took us down into a tunnel. It was nearly completely and utterly dark, with no oxygen. There was a bathroom with no water. They didn't bring us water to drink. They didn't bring us food. They just left us there. I can't explain what that feeling is, that you're lying there and you feel that it's going to be your last breath and that you're going to die.
You've spoken more and more about some of the violence that you witnessed, not just involving yourself, but also involving others, including women and including sexual violence. What can you tell me specifically about that?
One of the girls went to the bathroom, and when she came back, I could see that something happened. I didn't know what happened. And she was very quiet for a couple of hours. And then she came up to me and she whispered and she said, he told me not to say anything. And he said that if I do, he's going to kill me. He touched me. One of the girls came and told us that she went through a lot too. She wasn't with us in the house, but it was in a different house. And she went through one of the things, the worst things that anybody can ever go in life. He touched her all over and asked her to do different things to him while he was naked. But she was threatened with a gun all that time. The worst thing.
On the 50th day in captivity, she was told by one of her captors that she would be returning to Israel as part of the November truce. It saw 105 hostages exchanged for Palestinian prisoners, but Keith's freedom was not part of that deal.
And I gave him a hug, and I told him that I'm going, that he said that I'm going to Israel, and that he has to be strong for me, and I'm going to be strong for him. And that was the last time that I saw him.
Since her release, Siegel has campaigned relentlessly to get the hostages home. She visited Washington to speak to U.S. lawmakers and the U.N. in Geneva.
I want a better life for the people that live in Gaza, that aren't terrorists. I want them to have food. I want them to have water. I want them to have houses. I want them to live.
Israel and Hamas still appear far apart on a ceasefire. Mediators have proposed a six-week truce during which Hamas would free 40 women, children, and elderly or sick hostages, which could include Keith. But Hamas has rejected that. It's demanding a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and a permanent ceasefire. Chris Brown, CBC News, Tel Aviv.
It's not what you'd expect to see on university campuses in the U.S., but today more metal barricades, even plywood barriers, were set up around some of the most prestigious post-secondary institutions in that country as protests and tensions ramp up even further over the Israel-Hamas war. Cameron McIntosh has the latest details.
At New York University, police moved in overnight, arresting more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators amid anti-police chants, followed by another student walkout today, one of many new demonstrations expected on U.S. college campuses, in the wake of a near week-long demonstration at New York's Columbia University, now stretching into the Jewish holiday of Passover. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators insisting the school break academic and financial ties with the state of Israel.
We're fighting against the complicity of our own university.
Isra Hirsi was arrested last week.
At the end of the day, we're anti-war.
But many Jewish students and faculty say they've been threatened.
We don't feel comfortable walking around.
Police were called in last week and arrested 100 demonstrators. Across campus, there's round criticism on all sides of the university's president for failing to find a balance between safety and free speech. Ava Lyon Serrano is a student.
I know for a fact people would probably feel a lot calmer if everything in campus wasn't fenced off and if we didn't have like hundreds of NYPD and riot gear here.
Other students, like Fenner Stevens, just worried about finishing the year.
I think they brought in the police too soon. I'm definitely concerned about graduation.
Yale also saw arrests overnight. And on the West Coast, California State and Berkeley also seeing calls to break ties with Israel. The growing protests over what's happening in Gaza also leading to more accusations of anti-Semitism. Kathy Hochul, the Democratic governor of New York, pleading for cooler heads.
People need to find their humanity. Have the conversations. Talk to each other.
In New York City, the mayor is defending the police actions.
There are people who come, have nothing to do with the issue, and they want to aggravate.
Columbia has already issued suspensions against students who have gone too far. Administration spokesman Ben Chang says police will stay amid continued vandalism and threats.
The current protest is in violation of university rules, full stop, and we are taking steps to resolve it.
So far, it hasn't worked. But this week does mark the end of the spring semester, bringing hope the debate, demonstrations, and division will move on to somewhere else. Cameron McIntosh, CBC News, Winnipeg.
The United Nations Human Rights Office is calling for an independent investigation into reports of mass graves at two hospitals in Gaza. Palestinian officials say more than 300 bodies have been found at Nasser and Al-Shifa hospitals. They are accusing the Israeli military of executions. The IDF has denied the claim. UN human rights spokesperson Ravina Shemdasani says the investigation needs to be international.
So we feel the need to raise the alarm, because clearly there have been multiple bodies discovered. We don't know how many. There are reports that some of them had their hands tied, which of course indicates serious violations of international human rights law.
Shemdasani says the UN is also working to corroborate the reports.
Coming up on the podcast, can something that is everywhere ever be eliminated? The push to reduce plastic. Canada Post says no to collecting banned guns. Plus, a drug cartel targets Canadian seniors hoping for a sunny getaway. A new doping scandal in sports has surfaced just a few months before the Paris Olympics. It involves 23 swimmers from China and the use of a potent performance-enhancing drug ahead of the last Summer Olympics. Sarah Levitt breaks down this controversy and the calls for reform.
And here we go.
It was a race that had Canadians on the edge of their seats. The women's 4x200 freestyle relay final at the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games, featuring then 14-year-old swimming phenom Summer McIntosh.
China's gonna get the gold medal. Yes, they do. It's a world record.
With China, the U.S., and Australia just ahead of them, the Canadian women missed out on a medal. But now those results and others are being called into question.
Sie wurden dreimal Olympiasieger.
Investigations by German broadcaster ARD and the New York Times have revealed 23 Chinese swimmers tested positive for the same banned substance 7 months before Tokyo. They were all staying at the same hotel. The athletes were cleared by top Chinese officials who say they returned to the hotel 2 months later and found traces of the drug in the kitchen. They claimed the swimmers were inadvertently contaminated. The World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, chose not to intervene. It also didn't report the incident. Chinese officials say the reporting is false. As for WADA president Vitor Banca,
at every stage, WADA followed all due process and diligently investigated every lead.
Athletes are angry right now. They're heartbroken and they're angry.
Brent Hayden has been called the fastest swimmer in Canadian history. He represented the country in four Olympics, including Tokyo, before retiring.
An opening of a Pandora's box, because if athletes are allowed to just claim food contamination, what's going to stop other athletes from using the same excuse?
Others, like the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency CEO Travis Tigard, are calling for an independent investigation into the matter.
It's a terrible, you know, train wreck about to happen in Paris if we don't get to the bottom of this immediately and have major reconstruction at the World Anti-Doping Agency.
Those calls are also coming from Robert Keeler, who once worked at WADA and is now the Director General of Global Athlete.
If the allegations are false, then the world and the athletes, the anti-doping organizations, are calling for them to release all the information and have an independent public prosecutor review and determine whether there was wrongdoing or not.
It's the final.
Many worry without trust in the global authority on drugs and sports, athletes may not be meeting on a level playing field or a clean one. Sarah Levitt, CBC News, Montreal.
An international meeting began in Ottawa today with one huge task on the agenda: negotiate a global treaty to reduce plastic waste. Thousands of delegates trying to tackle the problem. Senior international correspondent Susan Ormiston takes us through the challenge.
The world is counting on us to deliver a new treaty, a future free of plastic pollution.
The chair of the UN-led negotiations, Luis Vaez Vodeviso, implored negotiators from 176 countries to find consensus here in Ottawa. It won't go smoothly, says Graham Forbes of Greenpeace International.
Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Russia have really led the way in sort of pushing for a treaty that fails to address the problem.
The divide is whether to cut production of plastics in addition to dealing with the garbage.
To end plastic pollution, we have to reduce and cut plastic production.
Industry groups say the focus should be on redesigning and recycling, not imposing production caps.
You know, our position has always been that bans don't address the problem of products in the environment.
Isabelle Deschene speaks for Canada's chemistry and plastics industry.
And there's a lot of plastic for a reason. Can we work to redesign those packages and ensure that they use less of that product, they use more recycled content? Absolutely.
But recycling has failed to scale the mountains of plastic waste, choking rivers and polluting oceans. Only 9% has ever been recycled worldwide. Environment and climate change Minister Stephen Guilbeault is searching for consensus.
The idea is not to say we'll ban the use of plastics. We have to make sure that we ban those that can't be recycled or that are very harmful.
Thousands of tons of plastic are falling out of the atmosphere and you're absorbing it through your skin. You're absorbing it as you breathe. It's falling.
Andrew Forrest, a multi-billionaire and philanthropist from Australia, has come to Ottawa to keep up the pressure on negotiations.
If you are from a fossil fuel company or a polymer company and you're here in disguise, you're not telling anyone that you're actually a lobbyist, you're coming to Canada, coming to Ottawa to destroy this.
Plastic pollution in oceans is expected to triple in less than two decades.
This process is really a once-in-a-generation opportunity to end plastic pollution.
These talks lead to a final meeting in November. Eric Lindeberg of the Worldwide Fund for Nature says all eyes are on progress this week in Ottawa. Susan Ormiston, CBC News, Ottawa.
Radio-Canada has learned of a major setback for Ottawa's gun buyback program before it even begins. The federal government had planned on using the mail system to collect all the assault-style weapons it banned back in 2020. But sources say Canada Post has served notice. It will not take part. Evan Dyer reports.
We are going to do everything to make sure they remain illegal and that people be fairly compensated for something they bought back when it was perfectly legal to do so.
It's been 4 years since the Trudeau government announced a mandatory buyback program for a large number of semi-automatic rifles and shotguns. Today, he said the program is still on. But how gun owners across the country will turn their guns in has proven to be a more difficult problem than anticipated. And now Canada Post has told the government it doesn't want any part in the collection and shipping of the banned firearms. At a shooting range in Lange-Gardien, Quebec, owner Pierre Farron says it's more inconvenience for him and his customers who haven't been allowed to use their guns since the ban went into effect and are still waiting for compensation.
Fini. Pas d'utilisation, je peux pas y passer à personne d'aucune façon.
They're done, he says. Can't be used or given to anyone else. I can't do anything with them. They just sit there gathering dust. Canada Post has declined to comment, as has the union that represents postal workers. But sources told Radio Canada that the post office is worried about the safety of employees who would have to deal with owners who might be irate about having their property confiscated. Natalie Provost of gun control advocacy group Police à Souviens says her group wants the government to make Canada Post do it.
We don't really understand their safety issue, so we don't take no for an answer.
One reason the government turned to Canada Post in the first place is because police chiefs have made it very clear they don't want to be involved.
There has to be something that gives.
President of the National Police Federation, Brian Sauvé, told the Commons Committee that police have their hands full with other issues.
And is that going to mean that we don't respond to that mental health call, the person in crisis in the middle of the street, because police officers are now tied up going to pick up guns that are no longer legal to possess?
Also, the three Prairie provinces plus New Brunswick have said they don't want to participate in the buyback.
It will happen. It will happen in the right way.
Jean-Yves Duclos is the minister responsible for Canada Post.
As we mentioned, it needs a partnership. Not one organization can do that alone. It will be a partnership of organizations that will be able to collect, to transport and to destroy these firearms.
But just which organizations those will be isn't clear. And private courier services, who will be well aware of the government's difficulties, could be in a strong position to name their own price. Evan Dyer, CBC News, Ottawa.
Day two of testimony at Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York got off to a contentious start today, with the prosecution arguing the former president breached a gag order meant to keep him from disparaging witnesses. Then another day of testimony from David Pecker, with the tabloid publisher making it clear he was trying to do more than just help a friend. The CBC's Chris Reyes is in New York. Chris, let's start with that gag order. Some drama in court over that. What were the lawyers arguing?
So the prosecution wants Justice Juan Merchant to find Trump in contempt of court for violating a gag order that prevents him from talking about those involved in the case, including witnesses and jurors. Some have raised concerns about being called out by Trump's very public comments that are full of accusations. There are 11 violations that are in question relating to posts Trump made on social media about Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. Also brought up in that hearing, Trump's comments outside the courtroom about the jury being unfair. Trump's lawyers, on the other hand, argued that Trump is just responding to political attacks against him. At times, Mershon appeared so frustrated that he told Trump's lead counsel, Todd Blanche, that he's losing all credibility with the court. The hearing wrapped without a ruling, Susan, which could result in a fine of thousands of dollars.
And then there's David Pecker's testimony, which went on today. He made it quite clear that he was trying to help Trump politically. Talk about the significance of that.
David Pecker, as the former publisher of the tabloid The National Enquirer, which is read by millions in this country, is a key player in the prosecution's case against Donald Trump. Pecker confirmed on the stand today that he used his tabloid routinely to suppress negative stories about Trump in a practice known as a catch-and-kill scheme. So essentially, catch a story by paying for it and then kill it so it won't be published anywhere else. Pecker said this really ramped up in 2015 as Trump was running for president. He confirmed the meeting with Trump and Cohen at Trump Tower. Pecker said he was asked what he and his magazines could do for Trump's campaign. He was also asked why he paid for one of the negative stories about Trump that's cited in the criminal charges. He said, "I made the decision to buy the story because of the potential embarrassment it would have to the campaign and Mr. Trump." What we saw in court today, Susan, was the prosecution using Pecker's testimony to prove their allegations that there was a conspiracy to influence the presidential election, and that was the reason behind Trump lying in New York business records to cover up payments to the people who had these damaging stories about him, including Stormy Daniels. Worth noting that Pecker has been granted immunity in this case in exchange for his testimony.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
The CBC's Chris Reyes in New York. An Alberta couple faces financial ruin after being scammed out of hundreds of thousands of dollars. The elaborate fraud centered on a Mexican timeshare. Authorities say this type of scam is the latest venture for a Mexican cartel infamous for its brutality and bloodshed, now targeting Canadian seniors and their retirement vacation homes. Jonathan Gatehouse reports.
These are going to have to go to you.
Ron Pratt and Diana Paquette are boxing up in the midst of a financial maelstrom. Deep in debt, forced to sell the house in Edmonton and seek bankruptcy protection, the couple's troubles all linked to one snap decision.
We made a purchase that wasn't the smartest thing to do.
The timeshare in Mexico's Nuevo Vallarta came with some warm memories, but also hidden fees and undisclosed charges, ultimately leaving them unable to afford their vacation home.
Oh my gosh, it was so much.
So when the phone started ringing with unsolicited generous offers to buy them out, it seemed like a godsend. And all that was needed were a few upfront payments.
Yeah, well, they have like fees and stuff they want, like anywhere from $1,500 US to $10,000.
Small amounts that added up to nearly $200,000 by the time Pratt finally realized he'd been scammed. Recent warnings from the FBI and U.S. government link such frauds to one of Mexico's biggest drug gangs, the ruthless Jalisco New Generation cartel.
The more employees you have, the more money you need to pay them and to keep them loyal to you.
Université de Montréal professor Valentin Pareda studies cartels. He says Jalisco has been busy diversifying, seeking new revenue streams to underwrite its ever-expanding criminal empire.
These are business enterprises, and they operate largely with that rationale, thinking, how am I going to maximize income and minimize costs?
What really sets this phone fraud apart is the backstory. Fake websites for U.S. lawyers and brokers, official-looking forms and contracts, even follow-up calls from purported investigators offering to help recover the funds. Toronto lawyer Guillermo Cruz also practices in Mexico and regularly hears from Canadian victims.
The information that is provided looks real, looks accurate, unless you're familiar with timeshare law in Mexico, it's very likely that you would believe that the information that has been provided is accurate.
For their part, Paquette and Pratt have given up hope of ever actually selling the timeshare.
I'm really embarrassed. All I really was trying to do was get some money back for my wife and for my life.
And everything is just, you know, everything's gone now. Like,
now, as they move towards a divorce, all they have left is the memory of a brief shining moment in the sun. Jonathan Gatehouse, CBC News, Toronto.
And finally tonight, finishing a marathon sure is cause for celebratory drink. Or you could pour a glass after the first mile and the one after that.
So 26 miles, we're going to have 26 wines, white and red. I'm going to be trying to guess grape variety, vintage and country. Because I thought, how can I make the London Marathon as silly as me?
That's Tom Gilby. The 52-year-old British wine connoisseur put his long-distance running and tasting skills to the test at the London Marathon on Sunday. With two wine glasses strapped on his belt, Gilby stopped after each mile, where his team poured him a glass for a blind taste test.
Here I come to checkpoint one. What do we got?
A red.
Quite light in colour, quite fruity, ripe, strawberries, Pinot Noir. US, 2019.
2018, actually, but pretty impressive. Gilby was able to detect the correct variety, year, and region 7 times. He got 2 out of 3 right for 14 glasses. And there was one other accomplishment, too. He finished the marathon. And no, not by stumbling over the finish line. Gilby clocked a sub-5-hour time. Like a true connoisseur, he took just small sips of wine and plenty of water in between, all while raising thousands of dollars for charity. Thanks for joining us. This has been Your World Tonight for April 23rd. I'm Susan Bonner. Have a good evening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.